emotional connection that acts as an antidote to the terrifying isolation and separateness the incident precipitated. I needed your comfort and support then. I needed your touch. I need it now, Vera declares to Ted. Those feelings of being scared and helpless are still with me. When I think about the cancer coming back, or even when I feel the distance between us, I need to have your reassurance. Ted responds, I want you to feel that you can count on me and I will be there. I will do whatever I have to do. I'm not always good at plugging into people's feelings, but I'm learning. I don't want you to feel alone and scared. This is now a healing ARE conversation. 6. The couple now create a new story that captures the injuring event, how it happened, eroded trust and connection, and shaped demon dialogues. Most important, the story describes how they together confronted the trauma and began to heal it. This is like weaving all the threads together into a new tapestry. Now, as a team, they can discuss how to help each other learn from and continue to heal this injury and prevent further injuries. Continuing to heal might involve setting out rituals that reassure the hurt partner. For example, after an affair, a couple might agree that any contact with the old lover will be immediately disclosed to the wounded partner, or that the injuring partner will call during the day with his or her whereabouts. Ted tells his wife at one point in this conversation, "The crazy thing is that it was easier for me to comfort your sister just because she isn't as important to me as you are. I'm not worried about messing up and making mistakes with her. I understand why, once this had happened, you would naturally not come to me at other times, like when you got scared about cancer coming back. I see how we got more and more emotionally distant. I know how much courage it must have taken to bring all this up again with me. And I didn't help you when you tried this before, did I? You were trying to send out a distress flare, and I saw you as burning the house down. It feels good to me when we can share like this and not get stuck in all the hurt around this." Vera, in her turn, tells Ted, "I liked when you suggested that I help you out by waving a flag signaling it's a hold-me-tight time, Ted. It feels like you're really thinking about how to tune in and make sure this doesn't happen again." Ted and Vera moved smoothly through these steps, but other couples may have more trouble. If demon dialogues are chronic and trust and safety have dropped to low levels, the forgiving injuries conversation may have to be repeated several times. So too if there are multiple traumatic events. Even in such cases, however, one injury usually stands out, and when that one is healed, the others topple like a house of cards. On the other hand, certain events, most notably affairs, also complicate the process of forgiveness. There are so many points of distress. But here, too, there is usually one moment that encapsulates the injury. Remember Francine and Joseph? It was the way he told her about his unfaithfulness that broke her apart. That affair was brief. Affairs that go on for a long time are much thornier. Intentional long-term deception undermines our sense of our partner as familiar and able to be known. As a result, we cannot define our own reality and be sure of what is true. As we tell our children, it is best not to trust strangers. You never know what they will do. Injuries may be forgiven, but they never disappear. Instead, in the best outcome, they become integrated into couples' attachment stories as demonstrations of renewal and connection. Play and practice. 1. The first step in healing an attachment injury is to recognize and articulate it. Think of a time, an incident in the past, when you were very hurt by someone important to you, but not your partner. The trauma may be one described above or a hurt of less significance. What was the main cue for that hurt? Was it a remark, a specific action, or a lack of action on the part of the other? In the incident above, Vera says the worst moment was when she realized that Ted could offer comfort to others during this stressful time, but not to her. In your own incident, what alarming conclusion did you come to about this important person in your life? For example, did you decide that he or she just didn't care, that you weren't important and might be abandoned? What were you longing for when you were wounded? If this is hard to articulate, see if you can figure out what would have been the ideal response to you. What protective moves did you find yourself taking? For example, did you change the subject and walk out of the room? Or did you become aggressive and demand an explanation? Ask yourself, did I feel deprived of support? Did my pain or fear get dismissed? Did I feel deserted? Did I feel devalued? Did I suddenly see this person as a source of danger, as taking advantage of me, betraying me? Once you have a sense of this past hurt, see if you can share it with your partner. Marcy tells her partner, Amy, about how her mother responded to the news that Marcy had broken off her engagement because she realized that she was gay. "I remember the whole thing," says Marcy. "My mom and I were in the kitchen. I almost whispered it. I was so scared of saying it." She turned, and her face was like stone. She said, "I am going to pretend that you never said that. I don't want to know. How you live your stupid, crazy life is up to you." I felt like I'd been punched in the chest. I think I felt all those D's, but for sure I felt devalued. I left. That was what happened, and that was my decision about the relationship. I never shared anything personal with her again. She didn't want to know me. I just kept my wall up. I guess I was longing for her to accept me and comfort me. I was so lost back then. But I gave up on that. In fact, I didn't let anyone close enough to hurt me for a long time. 2. Reflect on how easy or how difficult it is for you to apologize, even in small things. Rate yourself from 1 to 10 on this ability. 10 means that you readily acknowledge that you have blind spots and make mistakes. Can you remember a time when you voiced your regrets in any of the following ways? The 4-second, where is the exit apology? "Yes, well, sorry about that. What should we have for dinner?" The minimizing responsibility apology. "Well, maybe I did that, but..." The forced apology. "I guess I'm supposed to say..." The instrumental apology. "Nothing is going to work till I say this, so..." These are token apologies that can sometimes work for very small hurts, but generally in the kind of injuries we're talking about, they only increase the wounded person's pain. 3. Can you think of a time when you hurt a loved one? A time when they might have felt deprived of your support or comfort, even deserted by you, where you might even have seemed dangerous or rejecting to them? Can you imagine sincerely acknowledging this to them? What might you say? What might be hard for you in acknowledging the injury? Partners often use the following simple statements when they talk about having hurt a lover. "I pulled away. I let you down." "I didn't see your pain and how you needed me. I was too lost, afraid, angry, preoccupied. I just shut down." "I didn't know what to do. I got all caught up in feeling stupid and worrying about doing the wrong thing." Think of the 5 elements in Ted's apology to Vera. He says he cares about her pain. He tells her that her hurt is warranted. He owns up to his hurtful actions. He expresses shame for his behavior, and he reassures her that he will help her to heal. Which one of Ted's actions would be the hardest for you to pull off? How do you think your acknowledgement might make the injured party feel? How might it help them? 4. Now turn to dealing with a specific injury in your current relationship. You can do this on your own, or while your partner listens and tries to understand. If this sharing seems difficult, start with a relatively small recent hurt. Then, if you wish, you can do the exercise again with a more significant hurt. Try to make it as specific as possible. Big, vague hurts are difficult to address. Perhaps you went through a difficult period when there were lots of hurt feelings. Was there one moment when that hurt crystallized? What was the trigger for the pain? What was the primary feeling? What decision did you make about the relationship, and what moves did you make to protect yourself? It was that time when I was just starting all those new courses and was so unsure of myself, Mary tells Jim. One evening after supper, I gathered up my courage and asked you what you thought about all my struggles and what I had done so far. I really hoped that you'd say that you recognized how far I'd come and tell me that you believed in me. But you didn't seem to hear me, and I felt dismissed somehow. I didn't show you how sad I felt, how much I needed your encouragement, so I decided to just create my dream on my own. I keep that whole part of my life separate now, separate from us. 5. See if you can now tell your partner what you hoped for in that hurtful incident and how it felt to not get that response. You might also share what it feels like right now to take the risk and express what you longed for. As you do this, try to avoid indicting your partner for causing you pain. That will only sabotage the conversation. As the listening partner, try to hear your lover's vulnerability and share what this evokes in you. Usually, when we really listen to someone we love express a need for us, we respond with caring. 6. If you are the partner who has hurt your lover, see if you can help your partner understand why you responded the way you did at the moment of injury. You may have to dig deep and discover for yourself how this response evolved. Think of this as a step in making your actions more predictable to your partner. See if you can help your partner feel safe enough to reveal his or her vulnerable feelings to you so that you will have a complete picture of what the incident meant in terms of attachment needs. 7. As the partner who did the hurting, can you now recognize your partner's experience, own how you inflicted pain, and the big A word, apologize? This is hard to do. It takes courage to admit that we're disappointed in our own behavior. It's humbling to confess that we've been insensitive or uncaring. Perhaps we can only apologize when we allow ourselves to be moved by our loved one's hurts and fears. If we can do this with sincerity, we're giving our loved ones a great gift. 8. As the injured partner, can you accept the apology? If you can, it puts the two of you on a new footing. Trust can begin to grow again. You can comfortably seek reassurance when echoes of this injury occur in the future, knowing that your partner will try to respond sensitively. And your apologizing partner now can offer the love that went astray in the original event. 9. Finally, sum up this conversation with your partner in a short story about the painful event, the impact it had on your relationship, and how you both recovered and intend to ensure that it doesn't happen again. If you can't imagine doing this play in practice, you can experiment by simply sharing with your partner how strange or difficult a forgiving conversation seems to you. Another way to begin is to agree on an injury that needs healing and write out in a few sentences how the conversation might sound if it followed the steps outlined above. Then share this with each other. Understanding attachment injuries and knowing that you can find and offer forgiveness if you need to gives you incredible power to create a resilient, lasting bond. There is no injury-proof relationship, but you can dance together with more verve and panache if you know you can recover when you step on each other's toes. Conversation 6. Bonding through sex and touch. We waste time looking for the perfect lover instead of creating the perfect love. Tom Robbins. Passion comes easily in the early days of a relationship. Almost every word, glance, and touch vibrates with lust. It's nature's way of drawing us together. But after the first captivating rush of desire, what's the place of sex in a relationship? Besides pulling us in, can sex also help to keep us together, to build a lasting relationship? Emphatically, yes. In fact, good sex is a potent bonding experience. The passion of infatuation is just the hors d'oeuvre. Loving sex in a long-term relationship is the entree. But we don't typically think of sex in this way. We've been conditioned by our culture and a myriad of relationship gurus to regard passion as more of a passing sensation, less as a durable force. We're told that the sexual fires that burned so brightly at the start of love inevitably burn down, just as our relationships, once filled with excitement, inexorably turn into prosaic friendships. Moreover, we've been taught to see sex as an end in itself. Slaking desire, preferably with a big orgasm, is the goal. We emphasize the mechanics of sex, the positions, techniques, and toys that can heighten our physical bliss. Sex is all about immediate physical satisfaction, we believe. In fact, secure bonding and fully satisfying sexuality go hand in hand. They cue off and enhance each other. Emotional connection creates great sex, and great sex creates deeper emotional connection. When partners are emotionally accessible, responsive, and engaged, sex becomes intimate play, a safe adventure. Secure partners feel free and confident to surrender to sensation in each other's arms, explore and fulfill their sexual needs, and share their deepest joys, longings, and vulnerabilities. Then lovemaking is truly making love. Just how important is satisfying sex in sustaining a love relationship? Good sex, it turns out, is integral, though not paramount, to happy relationships. Sex educators Barry and Emily McCarthy of American University in Washington, D.C., have surveyed the research in this area. Contented spouses, they conclude, attribute only 15 to 20% of their happiness to a pleasing sex life. But unhappy mates ascribe 50 to 70% of their distress to sexual problems. Satisfied partners see sex as just one of many sources of pleasure and intimacy, while despondent partners home in on sex and often view it as the chief source of trouble. Why is sex such a huge issue for dissatisfied partners? Because typically, it's the first thing affected when a relationship falters. It's not the true problem, though. Think of sexual distress as the relationship version of the canary in the mine. What's really happening is that a couple is losing connection. The partners don't feel emotionally safe with each other. That in turn leads to slackening desire and less satisfying sex, which leads to less sex and more hurt feelings, which leads to still looser emotional connection. And around it goes. In shorthand, no safe bond, no sex, no sex, no bond. It's easy to understand. As Harry Harlow noted in his book Learning to Love, primates are set apart from other animals by affectionate face-to-face sex during which the most vulnerable surfaces of the body are openly exposed in compromising positions. We simply are not wired to be wary or afraid and turned on at the same time. The safety of our emotional connection defines our relationship in bed as well as out. Depending on how comfortable we are with closeness and how safe we feel about needing our loved one, we will have different goals in bed. I call these three kinds of sex sealed-off sex, solace sex, and synchrony sex. Sealed-off sex. In sealed-off sex, the goal is to reduce sexual tension, achieve orgasm, and feel good about our sexual prowess. It happens with those who have never learned to trust and don't want to open up, or who are feeling unsafe with their partners. The focus is on sensation and performance. The bond with the other person is secondary. This kind of impersonal sex is toxic in a love relationship. The partner feels used and objectified rather than valued as a person. As her lover, Kyle, listens, Marie tells me, "I am a blow-up Barbie for him. Our sex is so empty. It takes me to the end of alone."
"I guess it can be like that," Kyle agrees. "But we used to be closer in bed. Since all the fighting started, I've given up on us. I stop feeling and sex becomes mechanical. Then I see you as the woman. It's safer that way. At least I know how to do sex. Closeness is harder. If I see you as Marie and think of all our problems, I just get upset. So I focus on the sex thing. It makes me feel better, at least for a moment or so."
Kyle shuts down emotionally because he doesn't know how to do closeness. But others, especially if they've felt betrayed by past lovers, stay emotionally aloof by habit or by choice. They prefer sex in which arousal and orgasm are ends in themselves. They're more likely to have sexual encounters that are short, often lasting no longer than a night, and they hold back from any actions that could invite emotional engagement, such as reciprocal touching and kissing. According to research by psychologist Jeff Simpson of the University of Minnesota and his colleagues, the porn star Ron Jeremy, who might be considered a sexual performer extraordinaire, advocates partner swapping to alleviate sexual boredom, but his rule is absolutely no cuddling. Emotional connection, the door to real eroticism, is kept shut. However, without doubt, the poster boy for performance-oriented sex is James Bond. In 4 decades, he's run through a host of women who are virtually always potential enemies and not to be trusted. Only once has he been in love, simultaneously emotionally and sexually involved. Bond marries the woman, and conveniently, she's killed off on their wedding day. Sealed-off sex seems to be practiced mostly by men. This may be due to the hormone testosterone, which fires up sexual drive, or it may be pure cultural conditioning. Men are taught early on that displaying too much emotion is wimpy. Not knowing where to draw the line, they often avoid emotion altogether. Sealed-off sex might also be the result of men's sexual wiring. Who was it who said, "Men are like microwaves, but women are slow cookers"? A man can move through arousal to orgasm in seconds with minimal communication. A woman takes longer to become aroused, and it's harder for her to stay focused on simple sensation. She needs her partner to coordinate movements and responses with her. She needs communication and connection for good sex. For both men and women, emotional disengagement closes off the richer dimension of sexuality. Young people who stay emotionally distant have more sexual partners, but they don't enjoy sex as much as those who are comfortable getting close to others, finds Omri Galath, a psychologist at the University of Kansas. In this kind of sex, there is excitement, but the passion is short-lived. The experience is one-dimensional, and so continual novelty in the form of new partners or new techniques is necessary if the turn-on is to continue. More and more sensation is the name of the game. Solace sex. Solace sex occurs when we're seeking reassurance that we are valued and desired. The sex act is just a tag-along. The goal is to alleviate our attachment fears. There's more emotional involvement than in sealed-off sex, but the main emotion directing the sexual dance is anxiety. Gilath's research demonstrates that the more anxious we are about depending on others, the more we tend to prefer cuddling and affection to intercourse. Mandy tells me, "Sex with Frank is okay, but to be truthful, it's the cuddling I really want, and the reassurance. It's like sex is a test, and if he desires me, then I feel safe. Of course, if he ever isn't horny, then I take it real personally and get scared." When sex is an anti-anxiety pill, it cannot be truly erotic. Solace sex can help keep a relationship stable for a while, but it can also feed into raw spots and negative cycles. When anything goes wrong in the mutual desire department, there's instant hurt and negativity. If this kind of sex is the norm in a relationship, partners can get caught in obsessively trying to perform to please or in being so demanding that it turns off sexual desire. When physical intimacy becomes all about tamping down attachment fears, it can drive lovers apart. So Corey tells his wife Amanda,
"Well, what is wrong with lots of lovemaking? I bet lots of people make love every morning and every night, and lots of women have 2 or 3 orgasms each time."
Amanda looks at me, and our faces register instant exhaustion and dismay. Corey sees this and turns away. He looks sad and defeated.
"Yes, well, it's not really about the sex in the end, is it?" he says. "The only time I'm really sure you love me, the only time I feel really safe with you, is when I have you in my arms or when we're making love and I'm really turning you on and you're responding to me with your body. Then I know you love me and want me. When I think about it, I know that these demands for sex are too much. The more I push you into it, the less you like it. Truth is, I'm so obsessed with losing you. Since our breakup last year, I'm just scared all the time. So making love is like my security blanket."
Amanda moves her chair closer and puts her arms around him. Corey rests in her arms for a little and then says in a voice full of wonder,
"Hey, you're holding me. You don't think less of me saying that?"
Amanda kisses him on the cheek. When Corey realizes that he can reach out for intimate touch and the comfort of being held, Corey and Amanda's relationship changes for the better, and so does their sex life. Solace sex often happens when partners are battling demon dialogues, and regular, safe, comforting touch, the most basic bonding connection, is missing.
"Sex used to be a place we could really come together," laments Alec, whose 10-year relationship with Nan is falling apart. "But now she never wants to make love. I just feel rejected all the time. Sometimes I get enraged. Every time I think of how she doesn't seem to care about making love with me, it hurts. She says I'm too pushy, and she sleeps in the spare room. In fact, never mind sex. We don't even touch each other anymore."
When partners tell me that they cannot be considerate of and watch out for each other with everyday acts of caring, I worry. When they tell me that they're not making love, I'm concerned. But when they tell me that they do not touch, I know they're really in trouble. The approximately 18 square feet of skin we carry as adults is the largest sense organ we have. Tender caressing and stroking of our skin and the emotions these actions evoke are, for most of us, the royal route into love relationships. Touch brings together two fundamental drives, sex and our need to be held and recognized by a special other. As the late anthropologist Ashley Montague noted in his book, Touching, skin-to-skin contact is the language of sex and the language of attachment. Touch arouses, and it also soothes and comforts. We have a vital need from our earliest moments to the end of our days for touch, observes Tiffany Field, a developmental psychologist at the University of Massachusetts, who argues that North Americans are among the world's least tactile people and suffer from touch hunger. In children, a lack of touch, of holding and caressing, seems to slow the growth of the brain and the development of emotional intelligence, that is, the ability to organize emotions. Males may be particularly vulnerable to touch hunger. Field points out that right from birth, boys are held for shorter periods and caressed less often than our girls. As adults, men seem to be less responsive to tender touch than our women, but in the men I see, they crave it just as much as do the women. Men do not ask to be held, either because of cultural conditioning, real men don't hug, or lack of skill, they don't know how to ask. I think of this whenever my female clients complain that men are obsessed with sex. I would be too, I say, if sex were the only place apart from the football field where I ever got touched or held. I just want Marjorie to reach for me and touch me, Terry maintains. I want to know she wants me to come close. I want to feel desired, wanted, and not just in a sexual way. It's more than that. No, you just want bang bang and an orgasm, Marjorie disagrees. Maybe that is all I've known how to ask for, he retorts. We cannot funnel all of our attachment needs for physical and emotional connection into the bedroom. When we try, our sex life disintegrates under the weight of those needs. The best recipe for good sex is a secure relationship where a couple can connect through ARE conversations and tender touch. Even sex therapists concur that the essential building block of a healthy sexual relationship is non-demand pleasuring. For this reason, I often suggest to couples that they abstain from making love for a few weeks. With intercourse forbidden, neither partner gets anxious or disappointed, and they can both concentrate instead on exploring all the sensations of touching. Getting used to asking for tender touch deepens a couple's bond, and knowing one another's bodies more intimately, what moves and pleases each other, becomes a precious part of a couple's only for you, only with you connection. Synchrony sex. Synchrony sex is when emotional openness and responsiveness, tender touch, and erotic exploration all come together. This is the way sex is supposed to be. This is the sex that fulfills, satisfies, and connects. When partners have a secure emotional connection, physical intimacy can retain all of its initial ardor and creativity, and then some. Lovers can be tender and playful one moment, fiery and erotic another. They can focus on achieving orgasms in one interlude and in the next on gently journeying to the place poet Leonard Cohen calls a thousand kisses deep. I used the word synchrony first in conversation 4 to describe partners' emotional harmony. I expand it here to include physical harmony as well. Psychiatrist Dan Stern of Cornell Medical School also uses the word when he observes that secure lovers are attuned to each other, sensing each other's inner state and intention, and responding to each other's shifting states of arousal, in the same way that an empathetic mother is attuned to her baby. The infant opens his eyes and squeals with delight. The mother coos back, pitching her voice to his excited squeal. The lover turns his head and sighs. The beloved smiles and strokes his flank, following the rhythm of the sigh. This synchrony gives a tacit sense of deep rapport and is the essence of connection, emotional, physical, and sexual. Emotional safety shapes physical synchrony, and physical synchrony shapes emotional safety. Responsiveness outside the bedroom carries on into it. Connected partners can reveal their sexual vulnerabilities and desires without fear of being rejected. We are all afraid that we are somehow not enough in bed. Look at me, says Carrie. I'm just a mess of freckles. Do you ever see a model with freckles all over her? I hate them, and when I think about it,
I just want to put the lights out. Her husband, Andy, smiles. Now that would be a shame, he says softly. I like your freckles. They're part of you. I want to be with you. I don't want a model woman. I like polka dots. They turn me on. Just like you say you think bald men like me are the sexiest. You do think that, right?
Carrie smiles and agrees. Secure, loving partners can relax, let go, and immerse themselves in the pleasure of lovemaking. They can talk openly without getting embarrassed or offended about what turns them off or on. Psychologists Deborah Davis of the University of Nevada and Cindy Hazan of Cornell University find in their studies that securely attached partners can more openly express their needs and preferences and are more willing to experiment sexually with their lovers. In the movies, lovers never have to talk about what to do in bed. It just happens. But trying to make love without feeling safe enough to really talk is like bringing a 747 into land without a guidebook or help from the control tower. Elizabeth delightedly tells me of the night her husband of 25 years, Jeff, was discussing a favorite sexual fantasy of being educated by a high-class lady of the night. Suddenly Elizabeth deepened her voice, assumed a French accent, and for an hour played the sophisticated lady of the night for her enthralled husband. You were so kind of macho that evening, Elizabeth says to Jeff. I never knew you could be like that. Jeff bursts out laughing.
I never knew I could be like that either. But then you were pretty different yourself. Where did my little shy wife go anyway?
Elizabeth laughs, then says, But the best part of sex for me, no matter what we do, is afterwards, when you hold me like I'm so precious to you. Secure partners can soothe and comfort each other and pull together to overcome unavoidable problems that are never shown in the movies, but are part of everybody's everyday sex. Frank, who is having erectile difficulties, which he shamefacedly describes as Charlie deciding to take a nap, is recounting a recent lovemaking date with his wife that had all the earmarks of a disaster.
Sylvie said something about my weight at the beginning, and I got ready to pout, says Frank. But then she realized what had happened and hugged me back to feeling okay. Then at a crucial moment, our 18-year-old came home early, and Charlie went for, well, I'd have to say a snooze on me.
Sylvie reminded me of the book we read that said that in a 40-minute lovemaking session, many men lose their erection for a moment or two, but that if they don't panic, it comes back. We found a way to laugh about Charlie and stay close. Then the cream we use ran out, so Sylvie had to go hunt around and find some more. Sylvie is now giggling uncontrollably.
Finally, Frank continues, when everything was back on track, I got a bit rambunctious and knocked the candle over. So then the curtain started to smoke.
He cracks a huge grin at his wife and quips,
Hot date, eh, sugar?
Picking up the story, Sylvie recounts how they decided to give up on making love and make hot chocolate instead. But then, she giggles again, Frank said something sexy and we made love after all. She throws her arms up and tilts her head to one side in a Marilyn Monroe-like pose. These kinds of stories thrill me. They demonstrate that we can still have spontaneous, passionate, and joyful sexual encounters and make startling discoveries about our partners decades into a relationship. They show that we can connect and reconnect, fall in love again and again, and that eroticism is essentially play and the ability to let go and surrender to sensation. For both of these, we need emotional safety. In a secure relationship, excitement comes not from trying to resurrect the novel moments of infatuated passion, but from the risk involved in staying open in the moment-to-moment, here-and-now experience of physical and emotional connection. With this openness comes the sense that lovemaking with your partner is always a new adventure. Practice and emotional presence make perfect. perfect is the best guide for erotic and satisfying sex, I tell couples, not seeking endless novelty to combat boredom. No wonder a recent survey on sex in America by Edward Lauman of the University of Chicago shows that married partners who have spent years together and built up emotional security have more frequent and more satisfying sex than non-married folks. When experts suggest that only fresh relationships flying the flags of conquest and infatuation can offer exciting sex, I think of an older, long-married couple that I know and how they dance the Argentine tango. They are completely present and engaged with each other. Their moves are achingly deliberate, totally playful, and stunningly erotic. They are so attuned and responsive to each other that even though the dance is fluid, improvised in the moment, they never miss a step or a turn. They move as one with grace and flair. Resolving sexual problems. The most common sexual problems reported in North America are low sexual desire in women and premature ejaculation or lax erections in men. This does not surprise me. Most distressed couples are caught in demon dialogues. Women typically feel alone and disconnected. They either push for solace sex or shut down sexually. Men become insecure. They move into sealed-off sex or experience sexual difficulties. Most often, when a couple can create secure connection, their sex life improves automatically or through their concerted effort. The shared pleasure and intimacy of renewed sex, as well as the flood of oxytocin at orgasm, in turn enhance their relationship. Once she is feeling more secure, Ellen is finally able to confide in Henry that she cannot orgasm with him. For years, she's been faking it. Henry's not offended or threatened by this. He's comforting and supportive. He also hits the library and reassures Ellen with the information that roughly 70% of women cannot orgasm from intercourse alone. Together, they come up with 3 erotic strategies for the Orgasms for Ellen project. Let's take a close look at how connection and bonding entwine in one relationship. Passion is not a constant. Desire naturally waxes and wanes with events, with the seasons, with health, with 1,000 reasons. These fluctuations, however, hit a nerve in most of us, and unless we can talk about them openly, can easily spark or heighten relationship problems. Many partners can tolerate infrequent intercourse, but they cannot tolerate feeling that their partners do not desire them. Dealing with such feelings is a challenge most partners have to face, even relatively secure ones. And so, too, for Laura and Bill. They've come to see me soon after Laura has recovered from a depression triggered by losing her job. Her doctor, who knows that a healthy relationship is the best protection against relapse, picked up that she had some issues with her husband and sent them to me for a marital checkup. Laura lays out her concerns. "We love each other very much," she says, "but, well, Bill was always horny. He was always touching me, and I liked that. If I didn't want to make love, I could say no and he'd accept it. We'd still cuddle and play and feel close. But now, in the last few years, he just doesn't come on to me. When we do make love, it's great. But if I don't initiate it, it doesn't happen. This hurts so much. We've been together for about 20 years. Is it that I'm older now and not sexy enough for him? I'm finding that I just go to bed later when he's asleep to avoid all that. But we're getting pretty distant here." Bill responds, "I just don't have the same drive I used to. These days work also completely drains me. You know that. But I like making love, and you are one sexy lady. I don't see the problem here. Well, except that you're feeling bad, of course." This is one of those times when being able to have an ARE conversation really matters. The question is, can Laura stay with her hurt and reach out to Bill and can he hear her protest and respond? Like you were saying, Laura tells me, when we fight, we can get caught in a kind of I push and Bill goes moody thing, but we can talk and make up. I think we have a good marriage, but it's hard for us to talk about sex. We've tried, and it gets a little better for a while, but then it's the same as before. Since they had already been able to look at negative spirals in their relationship and create more responsiveness between them, I suggest that we talk in the same kind of way about their sex life. I ask what their sexual expectations are. Bill says he would like to make love every 2 weeks or so. Laura says she'd prefer every 10 days. We all laugh. The problem suddenly seems to have shrunk. But then we focus a little more. Bill says that the only problem he sees is that Laura seems to be irritable and a little distant. If I ask her to come and cuddle at night, she often doesn't come, and I miss that, he offers. In fact, if I think about it, I miss it a lot. Laura starts to tear up. I just don't want to cuddle and then get into that place where I start to think you might show some interest in lovemaking and be disappointed. And I guess I've been too scared to even talk about that. You just ask me if I'm sexually frustrated, and then when I say not really, the conversation ends. I see Laura's anticipatory anxiety and her move into avoidance to protect herself. We agree that this inability to talk about the changes in their sexual life is beginning to come between and hurt them. I ask them to expand on their hurt. Laura struggles for a while and then is able to distill what is so painful for her. Some of it is a fear that you don't see me as a woman anymore. I'm just the wife, more wrinkles and a little pudgier than before. It's scary that I'm maybe not sexy anymore, not desirable to you. You hug me like I hug a friend. You don't seem to pay me that kind of keen attention anymore. It used to make me feel so good and so close. Bill is really listening, and he helps his wife out by asking, "Is that the heart of it? You feel rejected that I don't think you're sexy anymore?" Laura sighs and weeps and nods her head. Well, then when we do make love, I feel tense somehow. I do feel desired, for a moment. I know you're overworked and very tired, but I get that you can take sex or leave it. It's not important. Sometimes I think that if I don't come on to you, then that part of our life will just fade out, and you will let it go. I get mad now thinking that. So I say to myself, fine, I won't start it. He can go to hell. But then I have this hurt. She touches her heart. Bill reaches out and takes her hand. I ask her, is that it, Laura? Hurt is usually about sadness and anger and fear. You feel that sex with you is not that important to Bill. Is that it? Is there more? She nods, then continues, if I don't go and reach out to you and suggest making love, I'm stuck with all these feelings. If I do, her voice trails off, and she purses her lips tight. This is so hard to say. It shouldn't be so hard. We have a good marriage, and I'm a strong person. But it's terrifying for me to come on to you. It's like diving off a cliff. I never had to do that before. And when you smile sweetly and say that you're tired and turn to sleep, I just die inside. I pretend that it's no big deal, but it really costs me to ask you. Bill murmurs, I never knew that. What do all these feelings tell you about what you need from Bill? I ask Laura. She tells him, I guess I need your reassurance that you really value our lovemaking, that you're still invested in it, that you still desire me. I need us to maybe put times aside that I can count on so that being with me that way comes first sometimes. I need you to show me the way you used to that you're still my man. Bill responds eagerly. In a rush, he tells her that he has been so burned out that he's sleepwalking most of the time,
that he loves her and thinks of her with desire during his day.
But I never understood that suggesting lovemaking was so hard for you.
I'm so sorry, he says.
I worry that if I come on to you and then I'm too tired, my erection won't work so well, so I back off unless I'm sure.
They both begin to laugh and recount a few times when this happened, and they simply ended up holding each other with a little erotic touching and lots of feelings of closeness. This conversation was all that Bill and Laura needed to move their sex life back into a secure zone of play and connection. But it also acted as a wake-up call. I suggested that they come up with a sensual scenario to follow when intercourse wasn't in the cards. Bill helped Laura do this, and he began to suggest making love more often. He was also more careful to reassure Laura that when she did suggest sex, he appreciated her taking this risk. He in turn told her explicitly that he needed to know that she wanted him, that he did not want her to avoid closeness or sex with him. He reiterated that he loved and desired her. Bill and Laura also began to pay more attention to their lovemaking. Every room needs a little cleaning and redecorating from time to time, and that includes the bedroom. They read some erotic books together and talked for the first time in years about how they could turn each other on and have more satisfying sex. They reported that their sex life had improved, and so had their relationship. As I told Bill and Laura in their last session, sexual technique is just the frill, not the real thrill. They had the best sex manual of all, the ability to create closeness, tune into each other, and move in emotional synchrony. Play and practice. On your own. Was there a comment or a statement in this chapter that started you thinking about your own sex life? What feeling did it bring up in you? Write it down. What does this feeling, whether it is a body sensation or a clear emotion like anger, tell you about your own sexual life? In bed with your partner, do you generally feel emotionally safe and connected? What helps you feel this way? When you do not feel this way, how could your partner help you? What is your sexual style? Sealed off, solace, or synchrony sex? In any relationship, all three will probably occur sometimes, but if you habitually move into sealed off or solace sex, then this tells you something about your sense of safety in your relationship. What are your four most important expectations in bed? Think carefully about your answers. Sometimes they're not what we think of first. Partners have told me that their most important expectation after sex was to be held tenderly and caressed gently, but they'd never expressed that desire to their lovers. Do you feel that you do enough touching and holding in your relationship? A single stroke can express connection, comfort, and desire. When would you like to be touched and held more? If you wrote out a brief guide for the lover of blank and inserted your name, what would you put in it? Basic directions might include answers to the following. What helps you begin to open up emotionally and physically to sex? What turns you on the most before and during lovemaking? How long do you expect pleasuring or foreplay and intercourse to last? What is your preferred position? Do you enjoy fast or slow lovemaking? What is the most stirring way for your lover to move you into, stimulate you into, deepest engagement in lovemaking? Can you ask for this? What makes sex most satisfying for you? This may not be orgasm or even intercourse. When do you feel most unsure or uncomfortable during sex? When do you feel closest to your partner? If you can share the above with your lover, great. If not, maybe you can begin a conversation about how hard it is to share this kind of information with your partner. Can you agree on what percentage of the time you expect sex to be really stellar? Remember that in surveys, couples report that at least 15 to 20% of sexual encounters
are basically failures, at least for one partner. What do you want to be able to do as a couple when sex isn't working for you physically? What do you do when sex isn't working for you emotionally? How can your partner help you here? Create a movie scenario together of what this would look like on the silver screen. Play the perfect game. It starts with, if I were perfect in bed, I would blank. And then you would feel more blank. See if you can share at least four of your responses. Then tell each other one way in which the other is sexually perfect for you in bed and out of bed. Can you each think of a time in your relationship when sex was really satisfying? Share the story of this event with your lover in as much detail as possible. Tell each other what you've learned from listening to these stories. Think of all the ways sex can show up in your relationship. Can it be simply fun, a way of getting close, a straight physical release, a comforting way to deal with stress or upset, a route into romance and escape from the world, an erotic adventure, a place of tender connection, a burst of passion? Do you feel safe experiencing all of these with your lover? What might be a risk that you would like to take in bed? Can you tell each other the risk and explain how the other might respond if things went badly or if things went well? We used to think that thrilling, erotic sex and a safe, secure relationship were contradictory. Now we know that secure relationships are a supple springboard for the most arousing, adventurous encounters. And in turn, keeping your physical relationship open, responsive, and engaged helps keep your emotional connection strong. The next and final conversation further explores how to keep your love vibrantly alive. Conversation 7. Keeping your love alive. Anyone who's bored in marriage just isn't paying attention. A colleague's husband. Do you guys see the incredible changes you've made in your relationship? I ask one of my most delightful couples at the end of a very positive session. Inez, loud, red-haired, and always full of passion, replies, "Yes, but can we keep it, this feeling? My sister, she's mean. She tells me, 'You think you've found this love again with Fernando, but marriage is just about habit. It has a best before date like milk. In 6 months, you'll be back to all the old nonsense. You can't keep a hold on love. That's just the way it is.' I feel afraid when she tells me that. Maybe we will slip back into all that fighting and loneliness." The session ends there. But as I write up my notes, I find I have two voices in my head. One offers a quote from the Greek philosopher Heraclitus. "All things flow, nothing abides." This has to be true of love, I muse. Just consider the high relapse rates from couple therapy. Maybe Inez's sister is just being realistic. But then the other voice pipes up with a quote from the 11th century Chinese poet Su Teng Po. "Year after year, I recall that moonlit night we spent alone together among the hills of stunted pine." Perhaps moments of deep attachment are powerful enough to hold lovers together year after year. I think of our research showing that couples hold on to the satisfaction and happiness they create in EFT sessions, even through hugely stressful lives. Then I know the answer to Inez's question. In the next session, I tell her, "Everything moves and changes, but for love relationships, there is no way it is anymore. We're finally learning how to make and keep love, and it's up to you and Fernando now to decide the way it will be in your relationship. Probably, if you don't actively care for your relationship, the gains you have fought for will fade. But love is like a language. If you speak it, it flows more and more easily. If you don't, then you start to lose it." ARE conversations are the language of love, They shore up the safe haven that is your relationship and nurture your ability to be flexible, to explore, and to keep your love alive and growing. Conversation 7 is a roadmap for taking your love into the future. The steps entail recapping and reflecting on the danger points in